Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 66 of Season 5 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is John from the Dirty Harry Minute. Welcome back to the show, John.
Many thanks for having me, Rob. It's been a while. It seems like it's been a while.
Well, that's because, you know, we only were able to do half a week in with Die Hard. You know, the personal issues, you know, got in the way. So, you know, we only got to do, I think it was two episodes maybe. So hopefully this time we'll get through the whole week without you having to, you know, take care of other more important things in life.
Yeah, well, back then I had 2-year-olds and now I have 3-year-olds. So it's amazing developmentally what an extra year can do in guaranteeing sleep to parents. So fingers crossed everything's going to go very well this time. Thanks, Rob.
Okay. I hope so, too. I hope so, too. You know, it's the way these things work. You know, we need to that's right. We need to figure out how to, you know, how to balance everything together. So why not? Oh, yeah. All right. So episode 66 begins with Barnes continuing his brainstorming idea and ends with John getting rebuffed by the DOJ. So basically the way we ended things on Friday was that, you know, Barnes and his engineers are trying to figure out, okay, how are they going to do this? How are they going to find some way to communicate with the airplanes without, you know, the bad guys finding out? And at the end of Friday's episode, Barnes started getting this great idea. He started having this flash of an idea. And he basically started saying, so who says the radio signal has to? And then he got cut off. So today we continue with this conversation where he says, so who says the radio signal has to just beep? And one of the other guys says, right. We switch the frequency from the tower over to the one in the beacon. We pump up the wattage, and then Barnes goes, and we can talk to our planes, and those bastards who did this will never know. So, I mean, I have first of all, a few questions about this. I like the way that they explain this, okay, that they explain it to us of how the things are going to go. I like the fact that they finally have agreed on what it is that they want to do, and that they're more or less doing what Victor did last week. Okay, basically, you know, if you're listening on a certain frequency to you know, the outer beacon, the outer marker beacon. So all you do is just switch the number. So, you know, instead of listening to the, you know, you take the tower and you just change the frequency and that's it. And I mean, it sounds a lot simpler. I mean, I'm not an engineer. I'm sure that there might be, hopefully there are engineers listening here that will be able to tell us if this really is plausible, but it sounds plausible. Unlike a lot of other things in this movie that don't sound plausible at all, you know, that all they have to do here is pump up the wattage, whatever that means. I know what pump up the volume is. Do you know what pump up the wattage is? Are you familiar with that term?
Not really. I know scientifically it means just amplify the signal, right? I don't know. I'm assuming you've done the due diligence on that definition.
No, I didn't. I didn't because, you know, I'm not a science guy. And I figured it's not worth to have me try and explain the science of something that I have absolutely no idea what it really means. You know, I'm sure Jim's listening to this and saying to himself, oh, well, that's really simple. All you got to do is X, Y, and Z and then everything's fine. But that's why, you know, Jim, actually, I should have asked Jim. He would have been the perfect person to ask on how to actually, you know, understand what it is that they're trying to do there. Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe you can explain to me, Rob. Do you think it's reasonable that the bad guys don't know about this possibility either? Is that within the realm of possibility? Surely they'd know that there are other frequencies.
Well, we'll get there too. I have a big problem with that. I have a feeling that, you know, if they have all the equipment, then they're also able to listen to the outer marker beacon, And they would figure out that there's something wrong, and that, you know, why is the outer marker beacon talking as opposed to beeping? I mean, I know there aren't that many bad guys left that are listening to everything, but you'd think that they have everything being monitored at some way, shape, or form. Even if they just keep it on a speaker, you know, they would be able to hear that. You know, they would hear this constant beeping. I mean, I've tried to understand what the whole idea of the outer marker beacon is, you know, that it's just, you know, making a beep, beep, beep sound, as Barnes says. But if that's the case, does that mean that there's someone on each plane that is constantly listening just to a beeping sound? Or is it like a background noise? Is it like that you cross over something, you hear the beep, and you're like, okay, I'm there. And then that's it. You know, that's my biggest question about it. And, you know, a few weeks ago, as everyone who's listening already heard, you know, I had Hal Bryan on, who is an experienced pilot, you know, and he was talking a little bit about how the outer marker beacon works. And, you know, my understanding was, okay, so it just, you hear the beeps and therefore you know where you are. But he also said that nowadays it's used less than it was 33 years ago when this movie was made, because the technology has changed a bit. But my assumption is that Stewart and his men are able to hear this, which is something that goes completely against everything that Barnes is trying to say here, because there's no way of hiding this type of information. If they have, you know, and first of all, let's even go further. Let's say, you know, Barnes doesn't even know that they've taken over all the controls of the tower. Okay. Which things in the tower they're able to do, which ones they're not, I couldn't tell you. But what I could tell you is that you don't take a chance on that type of thing. The assumption is that they have control of everything.
Yep.
You know, and just to automatically assume and say, oh, well, the outer marker beacon, there's no way that they're going to be able to hear that. That's just a little far-fetched in my mind.
Precisely. I'm assuming they've got an old-fashioned, you know, oscillator or something that's picking up every VHF, UHF, ZHF signal in the world to see at least if something's changing. You know, something changes dramatically, suggests there's another signal going out. But, yeah. Anyway, we can park that little gripe for later, I suppose.
Right.
But at the moment,
five of them are dead, and there are seven left that are monitoring everything, including, you know, guarding the daycare center old church at the same time. So, you know, there's only seven of them. So, you know, they're limited in what they can handle, but I don't think that you know, Barnes's assumption that they've skipped over the outer marker beacon is correct. You know, but I guess it works for the plot, so let's move it along. There's still so many things in this movie that, you know, don't make sense from in our reality, but in their reality, apparently it does. Apparently, in Barnes's mind, there is absolutely no reason for them to be listening to the outer marker beacon, so therefore, they're not listening to it. And I guess we need to take that at face value.
Speaking of things not making sense, this minute, watching it when you gave me this minute, it really helped me. I mean, it's a whole 10, 15 seconds of exposition recapping. And at the end of the movie, you think, hang on, like, why don't they just use those special phones? Or surely, it's a northeast corridor of America. There's heaps of airports around. Surely all of them have got enough fuel to get to, you know, nearby Virginia airports or whatever. But it covers that all off very quickly. And you sort of forget when you're looking back on the movie, oh, that's right. Why couldn't they? Yeah, you've got the exposition dump that covers it all up. But then you forget about this, you know, an hour later. And you go, oh,
correct.
Why couldn't they?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, on Friday, we talked all about it. We talked all about the fact of, you know, that they could have gotten to, you know, so many different cities with the 90 minutes of fuel that they had left, you know, and instead have them circle around. But again, that's what moves the plot forward. You know, there isn't much you can do about that. And the fact that they were talking about the airphones, you know, how only five of the 18 planes that are circling above have airphones, and they were only able to get through to two of them, meaning that Holly's plane, it doesn't matter how many airphones are on the plane, they can't get through to them. I mean, forget about the fallacy that you can't call an airphone. At least you couldn't in 1990. I don't know nowadays if you can call an airphone. I don't know if you would want to, because most people will just have, you know, Wi-Fi on the plane and they can use any type of, you know, VoIP to make calls to people. You know, they could be Skyping like we are, you know, while they're on the plane. So I don't think you really need.
Yeah. Where did you get to last minute on the issue of whether they could find portable lights to put on the runway? Did you sort of, I mean, Niall probably loved that bit about where do you get those lights, Batman? But I suppose they would have just been shot, or the bad guys would have found out somehow. And where did you sort of wrestle on that? Couldn't they have got lights?
Well, we pretty much glossed over it because it just sounds so ridiculous. You know,
yeah.
It's not something we talked more about, the fact that Batman uses it, as opposed to, you know, whether it's feasible for them to use it here on the plane or not, you know, on the ground. I mean, there are other problems that we talked about last week. Okay, the fact that, you know, when Sam Coleman is giving her report and she mentions the fact that only one runway has been closed, but if she's standing out at the runway, she would see that all the runway lights on all the other runways are also on.
Yeah.
So
yeah, exactly. Yep.
You know, so I don't know, just, you know, hauling out a whole bunch of portable lights just isn't really very feasible. So we didn't really go into that much detail on it. I mean, Niall was on it, you know, week three, and, you know, we didn't talk about Batman at the time, and, you know, there wasn't he wasn't on last week, so I couldn't really discuss that with him, even though it would be interesting to hear his take on it. So Niall, if you're listening, you know, feel free to let us know what you think about using the bat signal to try to help land these planes. Who knows?
I'm sure your guests have made a lot of jokes about Airplane, you know, the parody of Airplane. Put all the lights you can on
yes,
that field.
Of course.
And then, yeah, blah, blah, blah. I don't know what I should mention and not. But
You can mention whatever you want. That's fine. You know,
we probably talked about this motley group of Cardigan sort of planners. They're jumping into action now. They've got a plan that Barnes has enlightened them on. And I don't think we sort of see them again. Oh, we don't talk to them, do we? Any of his colleagues here by the machines?
No, I don't think so. I believe this is the only time we actually even see them.
And what struck me was
actually one of them said, "Let's run down to Radio Shack." You know that.
Oh yeah, yeah. What struck me, Rob, was the general age of these sort of whiz. Like, if it was a new movie, it'd be young, snappy kids with witty dialogue, like, you know, the guy in the Bond movie, the new Q. There'd be young kids with snarky comments, but here it was sort of. Still the middle-aged actors that were given these sort of roles, anonymous sort of background planning characters.
Which I would say makes sense, because, you know, that is what was going on in the late 80s and early 90s. You know,
yeah.
it was still a time where most of the people who were dealing with that are middle-aged, as opposed to being, because you want experienced people there. You know, they
also
they
want
claim,
people with good eyesight. Not to, you know, put limits on
who they also claim that this type of job is one of the most stressful jobs that one can hold.
Yeah.
So, you know, you want someone who's able to handle that stress. And I guess the assumption is that someone who's been doing it for 20 years can handle the stress better than someone who's just out of university or something like that.
I don't know, man. One of them's cracking. One of them's, you see, one of them's got a Venus flytrap on his in the background there. I don't know if that suggests a stable mind. Then again, I don't know who would own a Venus flytrap. Probably very kind people.
Possibly. I actually didn't even notice that there was someone with a Venus flytrap. Where did you? Oh, there you go. That's
either
right.
That or a watermelon.
It's Audrey. Yeah.
Audrey.
Is that Audrey? Audrey 2? Audrey 3? From Little Shop of Hers.
Oh yes, that's right. Yes, also I get you. It's been a while.
Oh,
since
wow,
I've seen
I did. You. I didn't even catch that. That is a great catch, John. You know, I did not see that
trap itself
beforehand. Wow, that's very cool. Yeah, he's and finding out who these guys are is virtually impossible, because on IMDb they have like 12 people listed as engineers. And,
right.
You know, just going through them by pictures doesn't really help, because, you know, the ones who do have pictures, the pictures don't necessarily resemble what they look like 33 years ago. So it's a little more difficult to try and figure it out. You know, and unfortunately, some of them have passed on. So it's not that simple to figure out. And they also all pretty much have throwaway lines here. You know, they're there to give Barnes the support that he needs, but that's about it. So yeah, I can't tell you who any of them are. And then the scene changes, and we're back in the police station, and we see someone drop a very large box on a countertop that looks like it's been ripped, because it has like a ribbon that was connected to something and it was ripped out, that type of thing. And then one of the guys in blue light, who is listed here as the second sergeant, that's how he's listed in the credits here, played by Jason Ross Azekiwa. I probably completely mangled that name, but how do you spell that? So he spells it, so Jason Ross - Azikiwe. And he actually has a lot of credits on IMDb. He has 44 credits, but most of them are TV shows that he was on, like one episode or two episodes of. I went through the list. There was nothing that really stuck out at me as, you know, something that I would remember him from, besides seeing him in this movie, obviously. And then he says, "Trace the signal, found it in the luggage area. They've been tapped into your tower chatter all night." So the assumption here is okay, this is what Cochrane and Miller were doing when they were playing around in the luggage area. Okay, this is a humongous box for them to have to connect, and for Cochrane to have somehow carried inconspicuously. You know, even if it was in the package that they were carrying, it looks like it's something that's pretty heavy. And when he was carrying the package, it seemed as if it was something that was a lot more, a lot lighter than the way it looks here. So I don't know. I have a little trouble believing that's what they have there. Now, did you notice that in the background when he drops that box and it like pans up a little bit, there's like a sign on a pole right next to Trudeau?
Oh, yeah.
Were you able to read what that says?
You are the first stop in stopping an injury. Oh, sorry, please then complete. No, I can't read the bottom lines. Mr. Optometrist Rob.
I can't read it either, but I was understanding that this is like for a blood drive. You know, you were the first stop in helping. That's what it looks like to me. It's very blurry. I wasn't able to get a very clear picture of it.
In helping something blood supply.
Right. And I mean the plus at the bottom is what really gave it away, that it's something that has to do with the Red Cross or something like that. I tried looking it up, tried to find this, and I couldn't find it anywhere. But it does look like this is what they're, you know, that I guess the police and it's funny that they would have this here, you know, after although the blood that has we've seen in this movie so far, you know, it's a little ironic that they're going to have this right here, because again, you know, the five SWAT guys are all from this unit, and the five of them bled all over the place. So, you know, now they definitely need a blood drive to, you know, not that they can help any of those guys, but still. Yeah, I don't know. I just thought it was very funny that they have it there. Now, what he says is, okay, he traced the signal. What signal? What were they looking for?
They once were again, we're to not. Find, yeah, we're not engineers. You know, but it's a bit weird that I don't know why. It's weird that the luggage area would be tapped into the tower, don't you think? Like, why?
That was my next question that I have written down here.
Strange.
Again, it helps the plot move along. I guess that's the reason for it. You know, because they didn't want to have that little fight somewhere else. You know, need to be in a secluded place.
lots of unexplained steam and stuff. I'm no doubt you talked about that in the relevant minute. Yes. Ridiculous.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah, so I have absolutely no idea why that would be in the luggage area. But again, and then he says they've been tapped into your tower chatter all night. But, so this is how they got into, their comm system.
Yeah.
You know, if they've cut off if they've taken over control of all of the equipment in the tower. So what exactly, you'd think if they had a bug in the tower itself, then they would be able to listen to all the comm chatter. Again, it doesn't exactly really make sense with what he's saying here.
Why do you think Grant's man has done this? Is it just to show that they're capable and a bit of goodwill to sort of throw anyone off the scent, like just to sort of show that they're competent? And I mean, they don't really.
Well, maybe this was part of all of the, part of the major plan, that they would have that, so that when Grant's men show up, they have something to do to show that they're competent. Meaning that it could be that Cochran and Miller's mission was basically a diversion. Mm-hmm. Let's hook something up, and therefore, when Grant eventually shows up, he's gonna get credit points for showing them, hey, look what I just did. I found, the way that they've been listening to everything that you've been doing. So give me brownie points for that, and I'm on your side.
Yeah. Throw people off.
I guess.
Yeah.
That's right.
And throw off little clues. Like when he barges in a second, he goes, I want to hear about that plane. It's like, don't you want to hear about the other stuff? Why do you want to know about the plane?
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. And then the shot pans around, and we get to see everyone else who's in the room. And we see it lingers on Lorenzo for a fraction of a second. And, he looks a little embarrassed at this point, because then John says to him, punk still in luggage, huh, Carmine? And he doesn't wait for a response.
Yeah, that's right. But it doesn't give the audience really much time to see Lorenz that embarrassed, because it's pretty quick. What's up with America? Why are these guys pointed in the air? Jesus.
Where else is he going to point it?
Well, down at the ground? I don't know. He's hyper alert.
There's a terrorist threat.
I guess.
Yeah, I don't. Have you ever held an M16 like that?
No, man. I'm a pacifist. Okay. Never. No.
Okay. All right.
It just seems a bit.
That's fine. You can be a pacifist, but sometimes you might need to use a weapon.
I guess so.
We're not getting into that. No, not here. But the bottom line is that I've held an M16 that way, and it gets very tiring. And therefore, no one who really knows how to use an M16 would carry it that way. You would have it strapped, around your shoulder, or across your body, or something like that. You wouldn't hold it like that. This is clearly an actor who was told, okay, stand there to look menacing so that everyone sees, the M16. That's all it is.
If you're playing your cards right, you could be in a Rambo movie next.
That's right. Yep. And then John turns around and starts walking away. And he goes around the counter and comes up to one of the other guys from Blue Light and goes, how you doing, Telford? And he goes, no good. I called Langley. They're rigging a portable decoder. It'll be here in 2 hours. So, I mean, first of all, it says a lot about the technology of the 1990s. Telford's job is basically to try and crack the code on their radio frequency that we're not able to hear. That's more or less what he's there for. And do you know who this actor is who plays Telford? Did you take a look at that by any chance?
No, I didn't.
All right. His name is Patrick O'Neill. All right. He was born on the 14th of September, 1967. He only has 14 IMDb credits, but he is the son of Ryan O'Neill and Leigh Taylor Young.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. And Juno, he's currently a sportscaster, and he has two children with Rebecca De Mornay.
Wow.
He's according to IMDb, they're not married, but they've been together for like 30 years or something like that. So and she's like 10 years older than him also, because he's actually very young here. He's only like 22 at the time this movie was made. He was born in 67. He was 23. Okay, he's 23 when this movie was made.
Do you recall other movies he was in? Anything else? Anything other?
Nothing. There's nothing. No, there's nothing that really stuck out. This was the only one that I really could see something from him. But again, for me, it was much more important knowing the fact that he is a companion of Rebecca De Mornay. You know, that stuck out more. You know, that fact. Yeah, he had small roles in Wild Hogs. That was his last movie in 2007. He was the family dad. Is there any other movie that he was in that I would even recognize? He was on one episode of Beverly Hills 90210. He was on an episode of China Beach. Those are pretty much the highlights of his movie career. So, yeah. And so, you know, Telford's job is to be the decoder. And then he gives us a very important plot point right now. Because first of all, he tells John, okay, that the decoder, they're going to send a decoder that will only be here in 2 hours, you know, which seems to be a very long time to get from Langley to Dulles, because the trip from Langley to Dulles is a lot closer than 2 hours. But I guess they need to find something. I don't know, because it's, you know, it's Langley, Virginia. Right. So what would be your guess? How long do you think it would take to get from Langley, Virginia to Dulles?
All right. Well, we do have Christmas traffic, but all things being equal, I don't know. I'm just making this up. Is it 50? Is it 50 miles? Would it take 40 minutes?
15 miles. 15 miles. Oh, it takes. It's close. A 20 minute drive.
Wow. Christmas so traffic.
A 20 minute drive. That apparently. Yeah. And no, I think it takes longer for them to actually find a decoder. And it makes it sound as if it's something that's really huge that they need to somehow disassemble and then reassemble when they get to Dulles. That would be my guess for that. Because they say they have to rig a portable decoder. You know. And then John's response is, well, my wife doesn't have 2 hours. And then we get this important plot device from young Patty O'Neill, who says, I was only transferred to Grant's team yesterday. The regular guy got an appendicitis. But word is, nobody's better at this than Major Grant. So I love the fact that they just throw this in.
Yeah. I mean, in real life. Yeah. I mean, we know why it's relevant. We know why it's important later on. But what an odd thing to say in real life. Unless, I mean, McLean already knows his name. We haven't seen him in the previous minute, has he? It's just a fast friend that McLean's made.
Yeah. Yeah, this is the maybe first time that we see that. Yeah.
So it's a very odd thing to say. Unless he's saying, I'm sorry, I can't unscramble it. I'm just a new guy. But we don't have any backstory on the character. So, yeah.
Correct.
Anyway.
That's right. Well, we'll find out later that he wasn't in Grenada. That's the only thing we can find out about him. So he mentions the fact of an appendicitis. Okay. But what do you know about appendicitis?
I know in old times it could be a death sentence, couldn't it, if it burst and you didn't make it to hospital? I know now it's pretty severe if it does burst, but it's not life-threatening anymore. I don't think scientists have worked out why we really have the appendix. Is it still a legacy of our ape background or something? That's my extent of my knowledge.
Okay, so we'll go back a little bit. So the first person to describe the condition of an appendicitis was a man named Reginald Fitz back in 1886. Before that, you know, people were dying from it, but they didn't know what it was. They just had a pain in their side or anything like that, right? An appendicitis is most common between the ages of 5 and 40, data from 2015. How many cases of an appendicitis do you think there were? and how many people died from it in that year globally.
Okay, so how many people globally a year?
In 2015.
Yeah, okay. I'm assuming it's relatively rare. Do you want to say 250,000 people got it? Because bear in mind, a lot of people in poorer countries still might not be able to get the proper diagnosis and they just die and they don't do an autopsy, so they might not know. So 250,000 people get it. And you want to say...
Okay, one second. I'll let you, I'm going to give you the answer on that one first before you tell me how many you think died. Okay, so you say 250,000. In 2015, 11.6 million people had appendicitis.
Wow.
Okay. Oh. All right, so of those 11.6 million, how many people do you think died from it in 2015?
Okay, 100,000?
50,000.
Ah.
All right. And that number actually went down because in 1990, when this movie takes place, there were 88,000 people that died of an appendicitis.
Mm. My dad had his appendix. Has anyone in your family had it? I've never known anyone myself. No.
Not that I'm aware of. It is the most frequent diagnosis for children who are taken to the emergency room, ages between the ages of 5 and 17 in the U.S.
Mm. Interesting. Okay.
They claim that it is something that can be hereditary. So it's more likely for someone who had a parent who had an appendicitis for them to also have one later on. But that doesn't mean that you will only get it that way. Okay. Now, do you know what does the appendix do? Do you have any idea? I mean, you mentioned something before about apes, but
No, I mentioned before. I remember reading the family medical book. It was probably in the when I was a kid. Probably dates back to the 60s. And I think they remember saying they weren't quite sure of its evolutionary purpose. Maybe like the tonsils, it's supposed to concentrate the disease away from the intestines. I have no idea. I thought they didn't know.
Right. So they actually never knew what it was, what it was used for. And people claim that it is not used at all. It's known as a vestigial organ, which means that it just doesn't really have any real use. But research from about 10 years ago started showing that there actually is some use for it, and that its job is to be a reservoir for beneficial gut bacteria, which actually helps and things like that. So yeah, I mean, it's supposed to be something that helps if you've been poisoned or things like that. Hopefully, no one listening will ever need to really know what they need their appendix for. But yeah, a lot of people, if it's not treated properly, you have more of a risk of it being life threatening with the whole thing. Telford says, "Well, word is nobody's better at this than Major Grant," and as he says it, we hear Grant scream, "Attention!" And then, we see a group of soldiers and people walking, and then John whispers under his breath, "Well, except maybe Colonel Stewart." And then, as Grant walks by, he goes, "I want to hear about that plane those bastards asked for. Then I'll fill you in on my orders. Pilots, briefing room now." And then John turns to Telford and goes, "Keep working." And then we hear Grant scream, "Alberston, sir, with me. Yes, sir." And it seems to me that he's doing this just for the pomp and circumstance. It's not really something that he needs to do, but he likes to walk through and shout these orders. As you mentioned earlier, part of the whole idea of him needing to mention about the plane sounds a little strange. He should theoretically already know about that there's actually, what they've asked for. They didn't ask for very much. They said they want a cargo plane, 747 converted cargo plane, fully fueled. That's all he asked for. He didn't really go into that much detail as to what he was looking for at the time. So it's just very strange. But again, it goes back to the fact that once you know where this story is going, so it's more for Grant to try to show that he knows what's going on and is able to handle the situation. You know, to give confidence to everyone around him that Grant is in control, even though we know the truth.
Yeah.
What do you think? Do you think that's true?
No, very much. And even John still has, you know, a 1 out of 10 wariness of, like, he's thinking all these things, like, in the previous minute, one platoon, and then he's one of your men. So he's having a little precognition, alarm bells are sort of, not alarm bells, but he's starting to think, hang on, is this what normally would follow from, like, where are the men in suits? All right, you've got a few Department of Justice officials, but there should be, like, negotiators there and a whole lot of other machinery of policing. And why is it just like a platoon of grunts here? So yeah, even Wheelis is a bit concerned, I think.
He's concerned, but he's not quite right here. Correct. But he's not suspicious that, you know, of what we're going to find out later, you know, that remains, you know, something that nobody's expecting, not even John. You know, you can't say that, oh, John's going to say, oh, I knew it. That's why they're there. No, not at all.
Yep.
So, right. And then basically the minute ends as this whole group of people, they parade along, you know, through the corridor, and they all go into this elevator. And as they're going into the elevator, John joins them, you know, which I think is really funny that he thinks that he's supposed to be, you know, part of this whole thing. And then the DOJ guy turns around as he gets into the elevator and puts an arm out to John and goes and starts saying, no, civil. And then he gets cut off in the middle of his word of what he's saying. But he's trying to say that no civilians are allowed. Now, one of the questions that I have is why would an airport have what's known as a pilot's briefing room? You'd think that that's something that sounds more military.
Yeah, I think you're right. I suppose I'd hope that every airport has a space where pilots can go and collect their thoughts. But I mean, these days, I don't think they have to retire and look at maps together and things. So yeah, it does sound a bit military, unnecessarily militaristic. Yeah. Maybe it was a change in the script. Do you think the actor who plays Trudeau looks uncannily like Joe Don Baker a little bit?
Fred Dalton Thompson and Joe Don Baker definitely have a similar look to them. There's no question about that. And you know that Fred Dalton Thompson was he became a senator. He was a senator for like 12 or 15 years, something like that. And then he ran for president.
Oh, blue or red? Was he a Republican?
He's Republican.
Okay, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
What do you think his look is? We see it like in the last few seconds of the minute. Because, I mean, he's pretty well disposed to John McClane at the moment, I think, in the
he seems to sympathize a little bit with John about the whole thing, that maybe they should let John in. You know, John's the only one who's been able to help us here. You know, that type of thing. But we'll see that. We'll get more of that look tomorrow. You have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the script?
No. Tell me more. Bruce Willis seems to have PTSD ears, but anyway, not an important point. Let's go on with the script.
Right. So the whole point with the engineers is exactly the same. Mm-hmm. The way that continues there. And then it says, after Barnes says that they can talk to them and they'll never know. And this is, and his face is brightened for the first time in hours. We cut to the airport police office and then say widened from a tubular electronic device with torn out wires at both ends as it clunks down on the table. The second triple T sergeant wipes grease from his hands, shows it to the men here. Trace the signal, found it in the luggage area. They've been tapped into your tower all night. So he doesn't say the word chatter, which is a good change that they made there. And it says, McClane and Trudeau look at Lorenzo, who looks away embarrassed. The young corporal has set up his radio gear in the receptionist area. Now he tunes in that garble. That's all we keep hearing. Can you do anything with it? Then Talford shakes his head and says, if I only had a few hours. McClane checks his watch. My wife has less than two. Talford sympathetically says, I only got transferred in yesterday. Regular con man got an appendicitis. But word is nobody's better at this than Major Grant. And McClane goes, except Major, except Colonel Stewart. The kid can't answer. Then Grant appears, the man from the Justice Department in tow. Grant says, Trudeau, Lorenzo, you brief me on that plane you asked for. I'll fill you in on my orders in my office now. My office, meaning Lorenzo's. Lorenzo glowers at that, but the little group moves in that direction. Then the justice guy puts up his hand to block McClane. No civilians. So, you know, I actually...
Pretty faithful.
It's pretty faithful, but I think it would have been better if they had left in the fact that he said my office, meaning Lorenzo's office. Yeah. As opposed to trying to, you know, instead of talking about the pilot briefing room, which we already talked about why that makes little sense.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So that's all we got for the script. So every Monday we have a segment called McClane Monday, where my guests will give their top five Bruce Willis performances. So what have you got for us, John?
I want to preface my rankings by saying I love Bruce Willis. But in the cold light of day, when I actually looked at his filmography, I thought, I haven't actually seen too many of his movies. But the ones I have picked on my list, I really like, and I like him in them.
John, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Number five. Bottom of the list, but still a pretty good movie and a great memory I have. I first actually watched this on a plane, was Mercury Rising. Suspenseful. I liked his rapport with that young kid. I can't remember if that the young kid was anyone famous. I can't remember a lot about the movie, but it was a great mood, so I remember liking that. Number five. Number four is his role in Planet Terror, the grindhouse one, you know, the second one that's not death proof.
Yeah.
Yep. Number three, probably get a lot of crap for this, but Surrogates. I like that. I liked him in that, and his relationship with his sort of wife that's plugged into the machine as well. Number two, Unbreakable. Really suspenseful. He's really good in it. I like the ending. Some people don't, but yeah, it's my favorite M. Night Shyamalan movie. And then number one, predictable, Die Hard. You can't top that. So those are my five.
Excellent. So you want to tell people how they can find or how they can get in touch with JBAM?
Please just Google Dirty Harry Minute on Facebook. You can listen to the podcast semi-regular, as in uploads once a year now. It's come to an end, but we're still active. DirtyHarryMinute.com, or find it on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or your favorite places. And the website, DirtyHarry.minute. .com has all our contact details.
All right. Excellent. And while you're doing that, you can go review and subscribe to any podcast you might be using to listen to this show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. And you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages here and